It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got lots of security news, including a zero-day exploit in IE8 and 9. But before we do that, we're going to talk to one of our favorite authors. Mark Rusinovich is here next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 370, recorded September 19th, 2012. Mark Rusinovich. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you and your loved ones online and your privacy online. And we've got a great show planned for you today. Let me first introduce our explainer-in-chief himself, Mr. Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again, as always. And before we begin, I didn't just double-check that you've got your recorders running, but...
I am recording this, because if you're hearing it now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, then it must have been recorded. So, according to time travel precedent,
that's sort of a time travel paradox
set by Isaac Asimov or somebody, we're okay retroactively. You know, there's that new movie, to me, it's like Paradox City. How could Bruce Willis? Anyway,
yeah. I don't understand why I'll see it, of course, because it's sci-fi, but the premise is that the mob 30 years in the future, which, first of all, doesn't seem like very far for us to have developed time travel all of a sudden, and then for it to be in the hands of the mob.
Yeah, that was quick. Those mob R&D departments work fast.
When they want to assassinate someone, they send them back into the past, into what is apparently our present. And it's like, wouldn't it just be easier to do it the old-fashioned way?
Well, there's more room for the bodies, apparently, in the 20s.
Maybe part of time travel is omniscience on the part of the feds or something. I don't know. Anyway, interesting.
I'm sure they'll explain that.
I hope they come
up. But you would think Bruce would know. Well, I guess he does know. Maybe there was nothing he could do about it. That he was going to... he knows the outcome of this whole thing. Otherwise, he wouldn't be there.
I will say something, and that is that there is something compelling about time travel.
It is.
Stories.
We love it, don't we?
There's a special pack of all the Star Trek time travel episodes across the entire set of series. The original ones with Spock and Kirk, then the Janeway ones. Janeway actually was getting herself in all kinds of trouble on Voyager. And you know, the various ones. So,
well, this is the kind of their version of the if you kill your grandfather, what happens saga, only in the other direction, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, well, it'll be fun. But we don't need to spend time with this.
No, because we have got something much better.
Introduce your guest. He's sitting here. He's lurking right next to you.
Someone much better. Our listeners will know. Actually, we told everybody last week, so unless... someone missed last week, they'll know that we have a special guest this week, Mark Rusinovich,
who
longtime security and computer insiders know from his work at SysInternals, where all of us were downloading fancy utilities that were absolutely unavailable in any form anywhere else, just like the best stuff. I remember every so often I'd go over and suck everything down just in case anything ever happened to the website that would cause them to become unavailable. Because they were so good. They were so important.
Oh, yeah.
And then, I don't know, I guess it was last year, Mark dropped me a note and said he'd written a novel. And I said,
what?
He said, I'd like to send you a copy. And I said, okay. Now, I have a review of his second novel, which is the occasion of his joining us on the podcast to chat a little bit about that and how we got into this and all that, sort of the human interest side. But I thought I would quickly share what I wrote publicly about Mark's work. I said, like so many of his terrific books early reviewers, I've known Mark for many years. Mark is a celebrity of significant note within the computer industry. but I only knew that Mark could write world-class code. I had no idea that he could also write world-class novels. And being artful at one certainly doesn't suggest any strong talent for the other. So being very picky, I worried when Mark sent an early copy of his first novel, Zero Day. I wanted to like it, and worried that I might not. So I'll just say that I wasn't the least bit worried. I was delighted when he sent an early copy of novel number two. If you haven't yet read Zero Day, you really don't need to, but I loved that Mark told his second story through the eyes of the two protagonists whom he introduced and developed throughout his first work of fiction. So by all means, click the purchase button above. But if you haven't already read Zero Day, why not begin at the beginning? Today, everyone understands that modern connected life requires some concern for online privacy and security. If you know very little about the details of how bad things happen to people online, you'll find Mark's stories compelling from that standpoint. They explain this clearly and intelligibly, wrapped around exciting narratives that bring those details to life. And if, on the other hand, you know your way around computer security, you'll find Mark's stories not only compelling, but also technically perfect. I'm so glad that Mark decided to share his imagination and storytelling talent with the world. Once you've read Mark's novels, I'll bet you find yourself recommending them to others as well. I certainly have.
Well, that's exciting. And we should mention that Mark will be back on Windows Weekly tomorrow, and probably we'll talk more about Windows tomorrow. But today we'll talk about Zero Day. Mark Krasinovich, welcome.
Well, and so... what I loved about the book, just by way of introducing it to our audience, you know, we have a special audience that have been maybe listening to us for 7.5 years. We've covered, as I was reading the book, I mean, everything that Mark discusses, we've done podcasts on, and we've come at it sort of from a dry, technical, this is the way it works, here's the technology side. And as I was reading this, I was thinking this would really be interesting for our listeners because the technology will be intimately familiar, but here Mark actually employs these things in a very interesting plot, and I mean, but that's exactly real, and it gives you a chill to sort of see this stuff come to life the way Mark pulls it together.
You're talking about his, of course, wonderful book, Windows Internals Part 2, now available in paperback. Oh, no, you're not talking about that. Okay. Welcome, Mark. It's good to have you on Security Now.
Thanks for having me on the show, and thanks. I emailed Steve when I saw that review. I'm thrilled and flattered and honored that he liked the book so much and that he took the time to write a review and share that opinion with everybody else. And it's great to be on the show.
Well, so I guess my first question is, how did this happen? What, you know, we all know you as a codesmith, and now you've written two really good novels. What's the backstory?
It really happened because I've always had this urge to write a book, a novel, like many people that get involved in reading when they're young, science fiction and techno thrillers, and I would read these stories that were so well crafted and yet built on solid technological grounding so that I'd read it and I'd feel smarter at the end. It was like I was going to school but having fun as I was reading the book and thought it'd be really fun at some point to challenge myself to construct something like that. And what pushed me to the edge of actually dedicating the time required to craft something was the strong belief post 9/11 and post SQL Slammer and Blaster and Code Red, that terrorists would see cyber weapons as an ideal weapon for achieving their agenda, which would just be indiscriminate destruction. We saw with those kinds of worms that kids would write them in their basements, let them loose just to see how fast they could spread without any real kind of malicious payload really involved with them, and yet they would cause so much disruption just in that form. So So that's what pushed me to write the book, Zero Day, was what I think is a realistic threat. And also one that I could tell a story that was a techno thriller built on technology and share what security professionals' life is like and what cybersecurity is all about and the kind of risks that we operate with because our systems and our lives are so dependent on computer systems. So that's what would push me to write that. And I actually finished it in mid or early 2006. It took me several years to find an agent and then a publisher and then finally get it out the door. So that's what was the impetus. And then I'd started working on Trojan Horse a couple years before Zero Day did well. Then I wanted to have another one ready to go. I finished it after Zero Day came out, and it was kind of the reception to Zero Day that encouraged me to push through and get that one out the door, and I've been working on a third one as well.
Whoa, wait. You just said you've been working on a third one?
Yep, working on a third one.
What is that in between writing Windows Internals? How do you find time to do all that?
Well, Windows Internals, as you showed, 6th edition part 2 is going to be out, I think, next week. It's RTM. Microsoft Press announced that earlier this week, so it's now off to the publishers and Amazon.com to get out there. But that's my last rev of the Windows Internals book. And that one actually finished several months ago, and I've been working with Dave Solomon and Alex Ionescu with contributions from some other people. So it's been kind of a low-level background activity working on the book for the last few years on the Windows Internals book series.
It's funny. I would have thought it would be the other way around. The novel would be the, you know, you go home and go up to the attic and spend an hour each night working on it.
Well, actually, the novel is that way, but the novel comes in more dedicated spurts than the book did. And the book, you know, the book research for the Windows Internals book and some of the original writing for the book started many years ago around the time Windows 7 RTM, as I was writing magazine articles and blog posts and researching and just being familiar with what the product was and researching areas that I wasn't directly involved in. So that has been kind of ongoing for a long time. But the novel work is more, I need to dedicate serious time and more shorter spurts so that I don't lose my train of plot and thinking and being immersed in it.
Is it like programming, writing a novel?
It is kind of like
what you just described. Sounds like a programmer might say that. I don't want to lose the thread of my, you know, you're juggling many balls when you write a program.
It is totally like a program. In fact, I experienced the same kind of context switching overhead, and there's a programmer term for you, when I working on a sysinternals tool, and then I am pulled off to do other things and return to it a week or two later. It's okay, I need to get back in the mindset of what this tool is and the flow and the architecture of it to figure out how to evolve it.
You have comments in source code to make that possible. What do you do in a novel? Do you have comments?
I've got notes of things that I make as I go along to keep track of what my thoughts are and where I think things will go. Things that I'd like to include. So I do have some of that to help me get back into it. But it's still, it is massive context switches. And even switching between writing and coding is a big context switch.
Sure.
Try to minimize the number of times I do that.
For what it's worth, having read both novels, I feel strongly that there is an important social good that you have accomplished. It really, those books are technically accurate. They give anyone who is familiar with what's really going on in the security scape, a deep chill, because what you paint, we understand, is absolutely possible. And I really did get a sense of almost foreboding, and that's a useful thing to be able to give people, for example, you know, decision makers in government who don't really get it, don't understand what's happening, because what you've portrayed is technically, it is happening at you know, like right now. And frankly, I'm very impressed that you wrote Zero Day 6 years ago, because it was contemporary last year. It was, for that to have been already 5 years old is impressive. You were looking into the future back then.
Yeah, and I was actually concerned in that gap, time gap, that something would happen and the book would become obsolete and wouldn't get out of
No fear of that.
But you said that,
I mean, we had Stuxnet happening, you know, at the same time.
It got more germane. It got more topical.
Yeah. I mean, I actually did. I complained to the publisher, what? It's taking so long. What, you know, it's going to become obsolete. They're like, no, it'll just become more topical. You know, they're putting a positive spin on it. But absolutely, I think I wanted to send a message to everybody, because everybody's involved with cybersecurity. Anybody running a small business, even in your home, you've got cybersecurity as one of the responsibilities for keeping your own data secure, keeping your identity secure, keeping your business up and running, keeping your customers' data secure, keeping our national infrastructure secure. And you've seen with the Cybersecurity Act of 2012 and the debates in Congress and the partisan politics that we've seen going on with that, there's a lot of people that don't get it. And also, I think that there's this anti-regulatory philosophy that that significant portion of our politicians have, which I think that if you look at some of the industries that we've regulated, it's hard to argue that the regulation was unnecessary and not beneficial. If you look at food, for example, or water, that regulate, and or the financial industry, the regulations we've got there, that we're not all better off because of some regulation, and yet they'll sit and argue no regulation necessary in cybersecurity.
But isn't the concern that the unlike food and water, that our governmental officials just seem to lack a basic understanding of technology? I think people are afraid that they're going to write something that look at SOPA that makes no sense technically.
I think that is a concern, and it's a valid concern. But I don't think that that's a good reason to say, well, we're not going to do anything about it and let everybody, and just have it be cooperative and voluntary and let people do what they want to, especially when the nation is depending on these systems for us to continue to operate well. So we've outsourced so much of our national critical infrastructure to private industry, and yet say, well, you can voluntarily have security best practices and voluntarily share information with us and voluntarily.
Right.
Now, and I just don't see that as working. It's not in their best interest to spend money on something that they view as maybe low risk, or, well, if it's going to happen to us, well, it's going to happen to everybody, so why should I encumber myself with being the best at it? The free market, pressures that people say will influence people to do the right thing, I don't think really are there.
Now, Congress recently decided not to regulate, but the president a couple of days ago proposed an executive order that would add some cybersecurity. Have you looked at his proposed executive order?
It is pretty watered down. It is focused on, again, the voluntary sharing and voluntary adherence to cybersecurity principles.
Right.
And I think I don't think it's enough. And I think that one of a lot of the language is vague, so it's really open to interpretation. But I think one of the theories about what this executive order is really aimed at is not for the president to come out and issue an executive order, but rather to scare Congress back into talking about a bill and getting the bill through, which is the right way that this should happen, not just the president issuing something. So I think I've read articles that people say it looks like it's potentially a bluff just to get people back at the table.
Was this Cybersecurity Act sufficient in your mind? Was it well written, well crafted?
Well, I think that the original Lieberman version was. I think that the one that after McCain got his hands on it became way too watered down. And that one, if you look at it, is basically volunteer versus regulation. And I'm not saying, when I say regulation, that it's just purely regulation. I think we need to have incentives to tax breaks and other ways of positive reinforcement for people doing the right thing, not just the negative side of it, too. But the Republican version of it is definitely, I think, it's closer to what the executive order looks like. And I think maybe that the Obama administration figured, okay, this is a first step. Let's just establish what we can agree on, and then we can build from there rather than just not have anything. So that's why you saw Lieberman say, okay, fine, we'll go with this one, and then it still fell apart.
You know, I guess it's as a consequence of the way the Internet sort of grew organically and the way computing and personal computer sort of grew organically. But I'm noticing this sort of a a schism between the or as a consequence of the amount of damage that an incompetent programmer can actually do. And I note, for example, by way of comparison, that attorneys and medical doctors have to get substantial additional education and then pass tests and essentially become certified. And, you know, programmers don't have anything like that. You know, like there's, I mean, but at the same time, it's sort of gone from a casual hobby into something that is really a potent tool for good. But if code is written incorrectly, sloppily, casually, a lot of damage can be done. And of course, all the license agreements say that there's no responsibility on the part of the producer of the software, which is another odd aspect to this computer industry that has persisted from the beginning. You know, what do you think about the idea? I mean, not that I'm wanting to impose regulations and you know, the same sort of, you know, MD degree and law degree on people, but something, it feels to me like somehow we need something to begin to tighten down the quality of the software being produced, because it's gone from not really mattering much to being, you know, national security and nation state level.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. One of the things we do at Microsoft is people have to go to SDL training, software development lifecycle training, which includes the threat modeling aspect of it. The threat modeling, but then what kind of tools we have available to us to make sure that the code is more secure. The tools that flag improper use of variables and, uninitialized variables, and then how you, the defense in depth things that we apply to our software. And Microsoft tries to help the industry in general by publishing SDL training publicly, and there's a number of companies adopt it. It would be great to see that, at least starting with people that are developing the systems that are at the heart of things like our electrical grid, our communication systems, that those people would have to have some certification in SDL and probably have it renewed every year or 2 years as well, just to make sure that they are at least aware that this is a way to look at their software to make sure that it's more secure and more resilient to attack. I totally agree with you.
Where would you sort of touched on this before, but I'm wondering where would you split the responsibility for the trouble that we're seeing between the technology suppliers and the technology consumers? That is, you know, how much of the responsibility is on the software authors, and, you know, don't users have some responsibility for their own conduct?
I think I would put, yeah, it's hard to put the blame on the consumer, because the consumer assumes, right, when they buy software that it's being developed properly and it's not going to have flaws with it. So I find it hard to put the burden on them. But I also find it hard to put the burden on the software provider in that scenario too, because they're sitting in a market where it's one of those, I've got certain competitors. If I spend too much time and energy on this stuff, I could fall behind on features and being competitive. And so what if it's secure if people aren't buying it because the company next door has all the cool whiz bang features everybody wants, even if it's insecure? And
right,
those guys are playing this risk management kind of situation. Well, it's unlikely to really come back and slam us in the face. And so if you look at what the government does, they've got this program called FISMA, which is now evolved to FedRAMP, where they'll say, we do have certain requirements for the software that we're going to deploy our applications onto and run government workloads on top of. that include things like making sure that you have two-factor authentication for your administrators and a whole number of other things that don't go as deep as the software developed using software security development lifecycle, but at least hitting some of the outside, very visible aspects of having a secure environment. In that case, it's the consumer, in the government's case, which has leverage, which is the money and the dollars required that they're willing to spend on buying these solutions. So unless we had all consumers be that way and have a certification and auditing, which the government has, then I don't see a way to change that dynamic between the consumers and publishers of software that people are using, like in the dentist office.
Yeah, so I guess there will, from what we can see, always be a tension between the suppliers and the consumers, but also a tension within the developer side between, you know, new and features and spending more time on security, but, you know, not having as many features. People talk about how nice it would be to have a closed system, which could inherently be more secure. The problem is, though, then they want, oh, but I need this and this and this. And so suddenly, you know, they push it away from being closed. And as soon as you do that, you open it up to exploitation.
Yeah. And we're seeing, actually, as we move to the cloud and we've got all these startups, agile software development, fling it out as fast as you can. And you know that you're sacrificing something there.
Yeah.
Which, it's good enough to run for now. We'll move on to the next thing. But at some point, it becomes a house of cards that you're playing with. So, yeah, I don't see a good way out of that dynamic without the kind of levers that governments put in place that really cares. And, you know, it's like paying taxes or eating broccoli. That's what security boils down to. It's or paying insurance, right? So unless you really believe that you're going to – that you're at risk of something bad happening, you're just not going to pay that price.
Yeah, if for example, the we advise people not to use the same password across multiple websites, and that's now becoming sort of standard. You know, if you really want the best security, this is what you need to do. But wow, you know, that's much more difficult to manage and maintain over time than saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to worry about that. I want the convenience of just using one password everywhere. So again, that it's exactly that kind of a trade-off of convenience versus security.
Yeah, and it's very few people are making that trade-off right now with passwords, despite the fact you see these huge password breaches that from one account service that enables the attackers to get into a whole bunch of others, related ones. So that's still not stopping people from doing that risk calculation. No, it's unlikely to happen to me. So I'm just going to continue operating the way I am and cross my fingers.
Right.
The other thing, too, wanted to point out about this regulation aspect and some of the arguments that McCain will make and some of the people against regulation and even government incentives for being secure, they'll say the free market will take care of it because if there is a problem, then there'll be a lawsuit, and that's the way that the free market will fix it. But I wouldn't want to bank our national security and infrastructure on, well, if it falls apart, well, then we'll sue the people that created the holes, because by then it's too late. The damage is already done. You're not going to recoup or fix things with a lawsuit and putting the company out of business after the fact.
Yeah. So, here's a big, wide-open question that I think our listeners would find interesting, which is, from your perspective, and this is completely wide open, what major trends of any kind do you perceive, like in the way the industry's moving, the way security's changing, the way attitudes are changing, development is changing, sort of where are things going?
Well, the bigger trends, I think we're right in the middle of the third disruption in the computer industry, the first one being the mainframes, the second one being client-server, and this one being cloud and mobile. So that's one that's affecting everybody in the way that everybody thinks about software, from enterprise developers to ISVs to consumers. But underneath that, as far as security goes, I think that what we're seeing, and I've been a proponent of this form of security, the security technique, the security mechanism, since shortly after 2000 when I started to really focus on what my software company, Winternals at the time, could do from a security perspective, and that is whitelisting. Back then, whitelisting was something that nobody used. There were Windows and Unix had some whitelisting capabilities, but very, very few people used it. And that's been the case up until very recently. And people, I don't think, are really aware of this, but now whitelisting has become one of the key security features of the modern client platforms. When you look at iOS, for example, Apple's ecosystem, it's a complete whitelisted ecosystem. The whitelist, you can only run the software on the phones that have been approved by Apple and curated by Apple. Apple is essentially creating their whitelist in their app store. And that has made those platforms, Android's got one, it's not as well curated, so we've seen the problem with that. And then Windows Phone's got a curated whitelist as well, and Windows 8 does too, that those whitelists, you see the dramatic impact on the security of the system by having that whitelisting in place. Even if there is, and the sandboxing that goes with the whitelisting as well. So I think I feel somewhat vindicated because I've always believed whitelisting would come back and become one of the primary tools in a cybersecurity posture or platform. And we're seeing that with the client platforms really adopting it and seeing the dramatic effects of that being in place.
And that's really interesting too, because it does parallel the same kind of evolution that we've seen elsewhere. We've talked several times on the podcast about how the very first deployments of firewalls were default open and blocking only specific things that were known not to want to be made public. And it took a while, but we finally reversed that model in firewalls, where it's default block, and then you selectively open availability for those services that you do want to allow through. And it was only after making that switch, although it's, you know, arguably more difficult, you're gonna perhaps false block when you don't intend to, but that's better than having, you know, everything open by default and blocking only the things you know you want to prevent.
Yeah, no, that's a great parallel there. And we see the mirror of that in cybersecurity, too, with the blacklisting approach of anti-malware. And just what I think is hard to argue not being a complete failure. I mean, the fact is, when I give a talk on security and sysinternals tools for troubleshooting security, I have a fake piece of malware, which... it's a piece of malware that I created, and it is malicious in the sense that it's a demo piece of malware, but it is completely unknown to the blacklisting anti-malware solutions. Now, if I tried to deploy that in a system that was employing whitelisting, it would be totally ineffective. It would get blocked. And very similar to what you were talking about with firewalls, where for a long time we operated with a blacklist approach with firewalls and then switched over to whitelisting and realized that was much more effective. I think the same thing is happening with anti-malware. The places where it hasn't caught up are on desktop systems and even server environments. Listing is not mandated as part of FedRAMP, and I believe it should be. Or as far as software that's operating our national critical infrastructure, there should be policies in place for what software is running on those systems and stopping any other software from operating on those systems, and that would go a long way to keeping those systems more secure.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, please.
No, I was just going to say, I was just going to wrap up by saying, so you do have a third novel to tease us with at some point in the future.
I do. I've been working on it, and it's called Rogue Code. It is, if you look at the first book, the theme was cyber terrorism. The theme of the Trojan horse was state-sponsored cyber espionage. And spear phishing, and the theme of this third one is insider threats and social engineering,
good,
if you use any weak spot in any system, you can have the best technological defenses in place, but if you have an insider, a malicious insider, that is very hard to defend against. And social engineering, of course, a slightly weaker form of the same thing of an insider threat, but also extremely hard to defend against.
Very cool. Well, Mark, thank you very much for joining us. And
we'll see you tomorrow. And actually, Lou MM, who is in our chat room, and I guess a colleague of yours is going to run over with a Heil PR 40 microphone for you to borrow for tomorrow. I think he's already linked you. But it really great to have you, and I appreciate you. Boy, we've been fans since the SysInternals days.
Yeah, I was going to say, thank you so much for all your contributions through the years to be able to have those tools. And they did not disappear when Microsoft sent you up. I remember when that happened. Everyone was like, oh, my God, we're going to lose SysInternals. No, Microsoft's got Mark now. And it's like, they're still around and they're getting better all the time.
Business as usual. Still, that's my other hobby is the SysInternals tools. Still
great.
Working on them.
Great.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's been fun.
Nice to meet you, Mark. Really appreciate it.
And nice to meet you, Leo.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Mark Rusinovich. Rusinovich.com, RussinovichCH.com, and then SysInternals is still on the Microsoft.com site if you just Google Microsoft SysInternals. I should have asked him if he's updating. We'll ask tomorrow if he's updating them, because I don't know if there's a Windows 8 version.
I remember looking at one of them not long ago. I needed something, and it was there, and it was current. It was
good.
At least Windows 7 current,
good.
And it was like, oh, thank goodness, this stuff is still around. So, yeah, it's just some of the best tools there are.
Yeah, part two tomorrow. We're going to take a break, come back with more Steve Gibson and security news.
Yep, we had a very, very busy week. This was nominally a Q&A week,
right?
But I thought with Mark and with so much news to talk about, once again, we just don't have a chance to get to questions. So I did download 289 pieces of email this morning, but you have another week to send more stuff in to grc.com/feedback, and we will do that next week. Today, or after... for the second half of this podcast, we'll catch up on the week's news, because there was a lot that happened.
Excellent.
I ran across a really neat note from someone named Philip Cook that I just wanted to briefly share. He had a success, not surprisingly, I guess, with SpinRite. He said, a week ago, I started my day with a blue screen of death, advising that I had an unmountable boot volume. Efforts by Adele Tech only led him to the conclusion that we should reformat the drive and lose all my data. Nothing would recognize the drive, and all of the check disk commands in the book could not even see it or result in anything but the same blue screen on every reboot. A MacStore utility that I ran from a downloaded file advised me to return the drive for replacement. After getting estimates ranging from $400 to $2,700, which, is unfortunately, it's typical because they often, it's like a manual process to do this, to recover my data, and trying numerous other tricks recommended by online chats, etc., I was fortunate to come across SpinRite. At first, the glowing testimonials seemed just too good to be true, and I will admit that I thought they may have even been fake. So I invested the $89. Downloaded the file, and fired it up. At first, I thought that it was going nowhere, because after 4 hours, it still said 2% complete. I figured I would leave it running over the weekend, and imagine my surprise when I came back this morning, saw the message that it had completed. It booted up, ran check disk, and then started Windows. All I can say is wow. Thank you for taking the time to create this program. It's bad enough losing data, but I also saved the hours it would have taken to recreate my desktop, links, etc. Needless to say, I am impressed. Philip Cook.
Yay.
So, yay. Thank you for sharing that, Philip, with me and our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Well, Mark is not involved in IE security.
That's an important thing to say right up front.
Yes. There is a serious, all a buzz this week, is a, I mean, Microsoft warning, you know, sending out emails warning about a new zero-day IE exploit that was found in the wild. It was discovered by a researcher monitoring some servers that were known to be used by bad guys. He discovered this on Friday, and it has since been found in the wild. The Rapid7 guys who manage the Metasploit framework have, you know, they dove in over the weekend and have already updated Metasploit to demonstrate this. Microsoft has no really good answer at this point. This affects all versions of IE that are current, that is to say, not Windows 8 and IE 10, but IE 9 and earlier across all versions. Apparently, the exploit that's in use now is aimed at XP, but there's nothing that prevents it from being used on Vista and 7. And in fact, exploits have been developed. I think the Metasploit framework instance is even more effective than the one that's out in the wild. So what the one in the wild is doing is installing the Poison Ivy Trojan that we've talked about many times, the so-called RAT, the remote
I like the name.
Takeover Trojan. Now, Microsoft's only response has been, they're not telling people to switch to Chrome. They really can't say that.
That'd be a good answer. Hey, you know, you might just want to use Chrome for the time being. Yeah.
They're telling people to install Emmet, E-M-E-T, the Enhanced Migration Experience Toolkit. The problem is that's not always effective either, and it can represent problems in corporate settings and in the enterprise where it conflicts with other things. So everyone's sort of holding their breath. I mean, the real solution for our listeners has probably already been taken, which is no one is using IE for their main surfing all the time anymore. They're using it periodically when necessary to run Windows Update, if they're running Windows Update through their browser, or only when necessary. Hopefully people have already taken the advice Microsoft can't give and switched to Firefox or Chrome, and then you don't have this problem. This is enough of a problem, and this next second Tuesday of October is far enough away, that is the 9th, that Microsoft did react to this immediately. I was impressed with how quickly they were on the ball with this when you consider this was only discovered on Friday, and I was getting mail Monday morning 2 days ago saying, there's a problem. Unfortunately, we don't really have a good solution. So October 9th is their next opportunity for their regularly scheduled in-band update. I don't know if they can be ready in time. Maybe they'll be ready sooner. So we'll see. But the only thing you can do is stay away from IE. Or I guess you can crank the security all the way up so that IE won't run scripting. That is one of Microsoft's recommended, mitigation measures. Of course,
use it anyway, right?
Increasingly, things don't work on the net. In fact, you can't even do Windows Update if you follow Microsoft's advice for making IE secure, because it requires an ActiveX control and scripting in order to work. So just don't use IE. You know, it's got to be
even IE 8, even IE 9, even.
Yes.
IE 10,
yes.
Even.
No, not 10. 10's
not out yet. So
10's not out, and Windows 8 is not out, and it is not, the betas
are not
vulnerable.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Well, that's good news.
So whatever this is, and there are very little details, I've not bothered to go, this is the exploit du jour, so I can't spend much time figuring out.
Nobody has time to read about all the flaws in the Internet Explorer. It's
there'll be
a full-time job.
Now, LastPass has just added an interesting service. They call it the LastPass Sentry service, which is interestingly enough, opt out for all LastPass users who are at the paid level, either premium or enterprise users. So if you're just using the LastPass completely free, this is not available. But if you're a LastPass premium, if you've given LastPass some money and are a premium user, then what LastPass is doing for you, and by opt out, I mean that you're in now, unless you tell them you explicitly don't want this, is they've made a deal with a group called Pwned List, PWNEDLIST, that are, this Pwned List group are aggregating all of the publicly leaked usernames and passwords. They currently have a list of 24 million of these. And so what LastPass is doing is making a daily check of their paid LastPass users' account email addresses against this master list. And LastPass will proactively notify any of their paid premium and enterprise users if at any point their LastPass account email appears in the Pwned list, which is very cool. They have interesting future plans, because, of course, the first thing I thought was, well, that's nice, except here we've recently been telling people don't use one email address for everything, because we know that that could be a problem, and that was essentially what bit Honan with his problems. So many of us have deliberately custom or differing email addresses, but that's not our LastPass account email. In fact, we may explicitly have, for security, the high value email is different than others. So we would like to know if those are leaking. Well, they say that, they say that they're working toward providing local verification of users' entire database of LastPass data against public leakage. To do that would mean that there would be an agent which was added to the LastPass scripting, the JavaScripting, which is running in our local browser since I haven't thought this all the way through. They would be, I guess they could hash everything and send hashes up and then check that, or our own machines could be checking against a list through a service that they provide, which is what I'm guessing they would do, is they would take all of the email addresses that they see, email addresses and usernames that we have in our locally stored LastPass in-browser database, protect that so that our security is preserved, and then presumably they would provide an API in their servers that allowed our browsers to check those in a secure way against this master pwned list. So it wouldn't be just our LastPass master account that was being checked, but all of the email addresses and usernames that we use with LastPass. So that's very cool. Oh, and they're also saying that they're working, their plans are, at some point, to work toward increasing the frequency so that it's much more frequent than once a day, more towards something closer to real time.
Wow.
So that's neat. Very neat.
Yeah.
Now, Symantec, this comes perfectly on the heels of what Mark was talking about with his novels. He's off the line now, so I'll just say to our users again, to our listeners, they're really good books. I can't imagine anything more interesting to the listenership of Security Now than what Mark wrote, because it is everything we have talked about set in a here's the way this stuff would be applied and how it, you know, and I mean, and how it escapes detection. And it's really neat. As I was reading book number two, Trojan Horse, I was thinking, wow, this is just so perfect for our podcast listeners. So it's fun. But speaking of nation state scale stuff, which is clearly one of, you know, the focuses Mark has had from his perspective, Symantec just produced a 14-page paper, which I posted a link in my Twitter feed yesterday, and we are now, I've got this in the show notes, and Leo, you have a person who is posting the show notes somewhere. Is this, I've never
on the wiki, wiki.twit.tv.
Okay.
Every show, theoretically, on the wiki, has show notes, but it's all volunteer, and so I had been posting stuff up there. I've given him all the notes for the past year's worth of episodes, and I think he's getting them all up there bit by bit, so I'm very grateful to our volunteers.
Well, I did have a number of people, or maybe one person multiple times.
Probably that, yeah.
Asking, he couldn't find some stuff that I had referred to in the last week or two. So I do want to explain that, you know, I produce notes with links to everything in them. And we're now, since Leo's got a neat volunteer who's going to be moving those into the wiki, I would recommend to everyone take a look at the Twit Wiki in order to find these. But also, my Twitter feed has it in this case. Anyway, it's a 14-page...
He's still catching up, I think. So it looks like he's got quite a ways to go still. So.
Maybe he could start on the most recent ones and work backwards. If that makes sense.
Right. I will suggest that. I don't know where he's putting them now that I look. Anyway. All right. So we'll see what's going on.
Okay, so this is gripping, and I tweeted it because it's another fantastic sort of real-world, bring-this-down-to-reality look at what's going on. And, Leo, I think on page 9, if you want to put that on screen, there is an amazing graph that Symantec has pulled together. I'll just read their overview because it gives you sort of a chilling sense of what is actually going on. And this is not a Mark Rusinovich novel, though it is just like one. They said in 2009, we saw the start of high-profile attacks by a group using the Hydrak, and then they said parens Aurora. And we remember Aurora being referred to as what was, I think it was the Google attacks, and maybe the RSA attacks were the Aurora Trojan horse. Symantec has monitored this group's activities for the last 3 years as they have consistently targeted a number of industries. Interesting highlights in their method of operations include the use of seemingly an unlimited number of zero-day exploits. Attacks on supply chain manufacturers who service the target organization, and a shift to watering hole attacks. Now, this is the first time I've seen that term. You know, we've talked about phishing attacks where someone is like spear phishing, where you know who you want to compromise, so you send them emails containing links or documents which will directly lead to their machine being taken over. A watering hole attack is Symantec's term, and I think it's going to catch on because it's a great term, where you know who you're trying to target, but rather than going after them, you are able to anticipate the websites they are likely to visit.
Like a wildebeest, which returns again and again to the watering hole on the desert veldt.
Exactly. So the predator lays in wait at the watering hole and attacks at that point. So they say the watering hole attacks compromising certain websites likely to be visited by the target organization. The targeted industry sectors include, but are not restricted to, defense, various defense supply chain manufacturers, human rights and non-government organizations, NGOs, and IT service providers. These attackers are systematic and reuse components of an infrastructure we have termed the Elderwood platform. The name Elderwood comes from a source code variable used by the attackers. This attack platform enables them to quickly deploy zero-day exploits. Attacks are deployed through spear phishing emails and also increasingly through web injections in watering hole attacks. Although there are other attackers utilizing zero-day exploits, for example, the SkypePot or Nitro or even Stuxnet, we have seen no other group use so many. The number of zero-day exploits used indicates access to a high level of technical capability. There are just, they say here, are just some of the most recent exploits they have used. Then Symantec enumerates four that we've talked about over time. Adobe Flash Player Object Type Confusion, Remote Code Execution Vulnerability, Microsoft IE Same Day ID Property Remote Code Execution Vulnerability, Microsoft XML Core Services, remember when that was happening a few months back, and Adobe Flash Player Generic Remote Code Execution Vulnerability.
There's so many. How can we count them all?
Oh, God. It says, in order to discover these vulnerabilities, a large undertaking would be required by the attackers to thoroughly reverse engineer the compiled applications. This effort would be substantially reduced if they had access to source code. The vulnerabilities are used as needed, often within close succession of each other, if exposure of any of the vulnerabilities is imminent. The scale of the attacks, in terms of the number of victims and the durations of the attacks, are another indication of the resources available to the attackers. Victims are attacked not for petty crime or theft, but for the wholesale gathering of intelligence and intellectual property. The resources required to identify and acquire useful information, let alone analyze that information, could only be provided by a large criminal organization, attackers supported by a nation state, or a nation state itself. So in this 14-page report, which, again, I recommend our listeners take a look at. I think anyone would find it interesting. Symantec details the structure that they have tracked down over 3 years, and how the specifics of the attacks, which might look disparate on the surface, you might not easily note that these things are connected. They've found the connections and built a connectivity graph showing how all of these pieces spread over the years are associated with each other. And they've also noted, based on the time, the windows during which the attacks were deployed, when the zero-day vulnerabilities were found, and when backtracking from the next attacks backwards, what they've been able to deduce is that shortly after a zero-day vulnerability is discovered and patched, the entire platform immediately deploys the next one, as if they have an inventory of these things.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
Yes. I mean, here we are from our perspective, you know, talking about, okay, what happened this week and what happened last week. It all just sort of seems like, you know, salt coming out of the shaker, bouncing around chaotically without any connection. But at least in this case, Symantec, by looking carefully at these and noticing things like common variable names and common deployments, they've got a Shockwave flash file, which they appear to be automated systems in place for like compiling exploits into this generic Shockwave flash package that allows them to quickly, and again, this is all about windows of opportunity. We understand that there are moving targets, that there are people looking for malicious connections and malware. So it's all about time. How quickly can you, get in and suck things out before the window is closed, before you're discovered, and you then need to come at it in a different direction? And interestingly, some of their advice for example, defense contractors is you really need to look at your suppliers, because what they're seeing is they're seeing that the one or two steps away suppliers who have relationships with the contractors they're actually targeting, the suppliers who presumably have somewhat less stringent networking security, sloppier management of their own websites and so forth, they represent points of entry into the network that then allows them to piggyback in on the relationship the supplier has with the contractor. I mean, this sounds like science fiction, but there's a map of this in this PDF. So it's just, I mean, this is going on. And so, there is reference to China. This does sound like a nation state that has a formal program assembled. And what's bizarre is this is a chunk of Mark's book, even though.
Oh, really? Oh, how interesting.
He called it public. Yeah. I mean, again, I read this 3 months ago in his book. And I'll say again, I'm amazed that he put together Zero Day in 06 because, Stuxnet was happening just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
That's like, whoa, okay. Which really.
He didn't have prior knowledge, I don't think, right? But it was. You think?
No. I don't think so. I think that
he just saw it coming.
Well, and you've heard me do the same thing.
Right.
If you understand the technology, you know what's going to happen. I mean, you can just say, okay, this is going to happen. And, there have been a number of times when that has come true. And so, he gets it too. He understands the technology. He realizes where the weaknesses are. And, and I thought he did a good job of sort of characterizing at the legislative level, the tension that exists. The shuttle software in the U.S. shuttle program had to be absolutely bug-free. And we can do that at an incredible expense. Software that's being produced commercially, it can get updated.
We'll fix it in post.
The cost of making it perfect, it goes exponential. You hit the hockey stick where to make it incrementally better, you've got to spend amazingly more money. You will get something for it, but is it worth it? And then there's, of course, there's ever-present time pressure and, competition who, eat your lunch because they're producing sloppy code faster. Yours is better, but, they're getting the sales that you're not. So it's not a perfect world. Anyway, I'd really, if somebody wants to have, charts and graphs and numbers rather than generalities, Symantec has put together, an amazing piece of work. Oh, it looks like it's on it's figure 6 on page 7, Leo, is a graph, of what they've actually found of the way all of this ties together. And they put together a beautiful paper. So I wanted to recommend it to people. Speaking of foreseeable problems. For the last couple of months, BMW has had trouble. The register.co.uk, in their typical inflammatory but factual fashion, they had a post recently titled, "Got a BMW? Thicko thieves can easily nick it with a $30 box." And they said BMWs and other high-end cars are being stolen by unskilled criminals using a $30 tool developed by hackers to pwn the onboard security systems. The new tool is capable of reprogramming a blank key that allows non-techie car thieves to steal a vehicle within 2 or 3 minutes or less. Onboard Diagnostics, OBD, which is a term, an acronym we're going to be hearing in the future, onboard diagnostics bypass tools are being shipped from China and Eastern Europe in kit form with instructions and blank keys, says a news report linking the release of the tool to a spike in car thefts in Australia, Europe, and elsewhere during 2012. Would-be car thieves need to grab the transmission between a valid key fob and a car before reprogramming a blank key, which can then be used to either open the car or start it via the OBD system. Okay, now that's one instance. There's a different one, which is related, but not identical. Back in July, Motor Authority magazine carried a story. They said, it's every car owner's worst nightmare. You wake in the morning, grab your keys, and head to the parking lot, only to find that your car is no longer there. While new technology such as chipped ignition keys and near-field communications key fobs have made cars more theft-resistant, they haven't made cars theft-proof. In fact, as Piston Heads points out, European fair trade rules have opened a back door of sorts for car thieves, one that allows them to create their own NFC fob to steal a car. We're not experts, and if we were, we wouldn't publish the info online. But it appears that all thieves need to snatch your ride is a diagnostic device that also reprograms blank NFC fobs. Break into a car via conventional means, access the diagnostic port, which is typically located under the steering column, and you can program a new blank key in a matter of minutes. And this works on BMWs right now. While BMWs seem to have the highest incidence of theft via this method, models from Opel, Renault, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Toyota, and Porsche are also reportedly susceptible to fob cloning theft. While Britain's Society of Motor Manufacturers is working to make access to key reprogrammers more difficult, doing so may conflict with EU's competition rules, which allow independent facilities to access all data available through onboard diagnostic ports. Okay, so that was July. So our update of September is, they said in July, we brought you news that car thieves, in Great Britain anyway, had gone high-tech, stealing new cars via the use of NFC key reprogramming devices. Instead of relying on old-fashioned methods to steal certain new cars, today's thieves just need access to the car's diagnostic port, a blank NFC key, and a key reprogrammer. BMW models built between 2007 and September of 2011 are the cars of choice for these thieves, and the Bavarian automaker has just announced a software fix that will eliminate the chance of NFC key theft on X5 and X6 models. Per Auto Express, BMW dealers in Great Britain will upload the revised software to owners of affected vehicles at no charge. Well, isn't that nice? While that solves the
problem... Your car's gone! by the way...
We have an update for you. If you can find your car, we'll happily give it to you. No charge.
Oh boy.
While that solves the problem for owners of X5 and X6 models, it won't do anything to resolve the issue on other BMWs. The company advises that a software upgrade is in the works for its other products and is expected to be ready within the next 8 weeks. In the interim, BMW is advising owners to park their cars in a locked garage or under the watchful eye of closed-circuit cameras. And then, in a sort of a strange, yeah, well, this would happen note, they said, even after the software updates are installed, expect to see a high number of break-ins of BMW vehicles.
Why?
Since the modification is transparent, thieves won't know cars have been updated and which ones haven't.
Right.
In other words,
put a sign in the window. I've got the new firmware. Move on.
In other words, even after the fix, BMW models will still be seen as targets of opportunity, so park appropriately. Now, I have a link in the notes I'm not going to dig deep into, but it is very disturbing about the onboard diagnostics. This was a presentation that Rob Vandenbrink gave to a SANS group, a SANS security presentation at SANS Fire 2012. It turns out that there is a set of standards, international standards for the networking technology that is across all cars. It is a CSMA CD, the standard sort of Ethernet carrier sense multiple access collision detection, which there are lots of tools for. It uses a serial protocol at, I think it's like 115 kbaud, but it's open. It's documented. You can give it commands. It tells you whatever you ask it, and it's ubiquitous. So, you know, when I hear you say, Leo, that Ford is, you know, is really, really, really taking this seriously, I'm glad.
Yeah.
And I have said to people, I'm glad I have an older Beamer that doesn't have any of this stuff in it, because I don't want it. Not probably ever. But, you know, that's just, it's a better way to operate. We're going to learn these lessons all over again. So, I mean, like, for example, it's mandated that all new cars have to have tire pressure transmitting sensor systems, and that's RF. And that's a way into these systems, because people that have engineered them haven't been willing to spend a lot of time, and they've been in a hurry, and, you know, same old routine again on our cars, which are becoming, you know, rolling networks, essentially, of small computers. So I have a feeling we'll be talking about these things in the future, and I'm glad Ford is really taking it seriously. In a surprising development, Google has added the DNT technology to the latest developer build. Do Not Track will be in Google's Chrome browser by year's end. Google's spokesman Rob Shulkin said that the Obama administration had asked the entire industry to adopt the Do Not Track technology, and Google was complying with that request and the consensus that arose around it. There was sort of I kind of got this sense reading the whole thing, of, you know, they weren't that happy about it, but, you know, they were the last browser without it. So they decided, okay, we'll put this in and let our users decide. Okay, a bunch of people tweeted this, and we'll have details probably next week. You remember, Leo, a couple years ago, that there were two hackers, one of whom was on the beach in Indonesia, communicating with a friend of his. We were imagining him, you know, sipping on umbrella drinks while he was reading the TLS CBC RFC document.
I remember that, yeah.
That was Giuliano Rizzo on the beach. And his partner, Ta Dong, they're back. They were the people who figured out Beast, B-E-A-S-T, which was the browser exploit against SSL and TLS. That was a man-in-the-middle attack, which they crafted by taking advantage of a weakness in the cipher block chaining, which is CBC, employed in SSL, in order to crack into secure connections. So, they now have a new attack called CRIME, C-R-I-M-E. That stands for Compression Ratio Info Leak Made Easy.
That's a retronym.
Compression Ratio Info Leak Made Easy. And I love it.
Yeah.
Because what that says is that this is a classic side channel attack. They've come up with a way, and it's not public yet. They're putting their paper out today, tomorrow, and Friday. That is September 19, 20, and 21, at this year's Echo Party in Argentina. They said that the new attack works much like the Beast attack. Once they have a man-in-the-middle position on a given network, meaning that they're in line in the communications path, they are able to sniff HTTPS traffic and launch the attack. Their current implementation requires JavaScript running in the browser. Rizzo was quoted, Giuliano was quoted saying, by running JavaScript code in the browser of the victim and sniffing HTTPS traffic, we can decrypt session cookies. Now, we all know what that means, because session cookies are the way persistent authentication is created in browser client sessions, so that allows impersonation. That's much what like what FireSheep was doing with Firefox some time ago. So we can decrypt session cookies. We don't need to use any browser plugin, and we use JavaScript to make the attack faster. But in theory, we could do it with Stack HTML. Rizzo also said that both Mozilla Firefox and Google Chrome are vulnerable to the attack. However, the browser vendors have developed patches for the problem that will be released in the next few weeks. Now, I saw elsewhere in researching this that browser vendors have stated they're no longer vulnerable. So I don't know who's right, but any browsers that support either TLS compression, which is a standard, or Google's Speedy. Speedy, of course, offers compression as well. Basically, what these guys are doing, this is, you know, we've talked about side channel attacks on crypto. The idea is by changing the data being sent or sending their own with and without compression, the content is leaked by the amount of compression it gets. So we know that completely random data won't compress much or at all. Pure entropy, absolutely random data. There's no pattern that a compressor can use in order to represent the same thing more densely. On the other side, a string of 10 A's takes up a lot of space unless you encode it as there will be 10 A's following, in which case it compresses extremely well. So the point is, the ratio that you get of compression is set by the contents. So by tweaking the contents, it must be that these guys are looking at the difference in compression and then reverse engineering what the unknown data is by subtracting out what is known. So a very clever attack. I'm guessing about most of this, but that must be, if they're calling compression ratio info leak made easy, that's what it would have to be. Now, you need TLS compression or speedy in this HTTPS link. So that would require support at each end. Both are still relatively rare. Some guy said, I read, my calculator doesn't have enough zeros to the right of the decimal point for me to tell you what percentage of traffic on the internet is subject to this attack at the moment. Meaning, you know, it's too far off to the right.
Yeah, zero.
Nothing. So not a big problem, nothing to worry about. If anyone is worried and you're a Firefox user, you can disable Speedy by putting about colon config in the URL address and then hitting enter. That brings up the massive configuration settings for Firefox. And then in the search bar, put in SPDY, and that'll give you a nice little block of settings. And I found mine said speedy network.http.speedy.enabled equals false, and .enabled.v2 is false, and .enabled.v3 is false. So I had mine all turned off. I don't remember why. I think because there were some concerns
you were worried, probably.
About it earlier.
You were
yes.
talking to Mark Rusinovich, maybe.
Yeah. So anyway, this I will probably have confirmation that this is the problem. It doesn't sound like a bad attack. I will try to determine what's going on here between one story that says the browser vendors will soon have this fixed, and then others that say they already have had it fixed. My Firefox hasn't updated recently. I'm 15.0.1, which is probably current. So maybe that had it fixed, or maybe that's why I've got Speedy turned off. Maybe that's what the point of the 0.1 was, because mine was all off. So maybe other people will find that too. We will see. And I don't know how you fix this. Maybe you pad the compression with pseudo random data so that it's not deterministic. That would block this. Anyway, we'll see what they suggest. But again, this is a very clever hack using the fact that different data compresses by a different amount to reverse engineer the unknown portion from what is known, which must be what they've done. And finally, before we get into a quick little bit of miscellany, our old friend John Graham Cumming was in the news with his most recent blog post. Blog.jgc.org. Our listeners will remember that we had John on about his neat techie book of interesting wacky tech locations scattered around the globe. And John has been a participant over in GRC's news groups for years. And what happened was, there's been news. I haven't been talking about it a lot because it's sort of always in the background of the depletion of the IPv4 address space. One of the Twitter feeds I monitor is unfortunately it shows a big atomic bomb mushroom cloud glowing red to remind us that we're running out of IPv4 space. And there was a recent announcement that in Europe, like the last one was gone. They were down. I think it was that Rife was down to one final network. And rather than giving people huge allocations, they were now giving them 1,000 of out of the 60 million IPv4s in this remaining /8 network. So being very, very stingy about them. And John somehow said, what about 51.0.0.0/8? You know, that whole 51 dot network. What's going on there?
Who owns it's, that, Steve?
It's registered, it's registered to the UK Government Department for Work and Pensions.
I saw this.
And you know.
How many addresses is that, Steve?
That's 16 plus million addresses. And they say it's in use, but it's not public. So they're using it like a 10-dot network. Mm-hmm. They're using it as their own privately routed, non-public sort of LAN in the same way other large organizations use 10-dot. It's exactly the same as a 10-dot. You know, I mean, I chose to use 10-dot for myself, although I hardly need 16 million IPs. And they're saying, well, we want to keep it.
Ugh.
And so,
no.
I mean, they can't. It's like, it's wrong. They're saying, well, 80% of it is in use.
Oh, okay. Replace it with a router.
Well, sorry. All they have to do is change the 51 to 10.
Yeah.
That's all they have to do. You know, I mean, yes, many times, but still, it is a publicly routable block that is not being publicly routed. Well, you know, John,
unless
we've talked
like
about
some sort of spy agency or something, right?
Remember that he launched the petition to get Turing's reputation like fixed.
And
one, because,
he got an apology from the Prime Minister.
Yes, a formal apology over the way they had been treating Alan Turing, posthumously, obviously. Well, he's launched another one.
Good.
There is now a petition in the works to bring to light and to bring pressure on. I'm sure he's not real popular with them right now. To bring pressure on this Department for Work and Pensions to give up their 51 dot huge. I mean, this okay? That's one. That's more than 1/256th of the entire internet. Wait, so is it 16 million or is it more? It's going to be 2 to the 24.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's more than 16 million. That's,
yeah.
Trillions,
isn't it?
Two to the 24. Okay, here's a little math. Oh yeah, I was right. 16 million.
16.8 million.
So that's a huge block, and they can't keep it because it is not. Yes, we need it, and it's not. Well, I mean,
and they don't need it.
As soon as it exactly, they're not using the public routability of it. They're using it like a private network, their own little private network. All they have to do is change all of those 51s to a 10, and everybody will be happy.
It'll be a little messy. But that's all right. I wonder if there are other blocks like that out there. Do you think? Do we know? That's just such an egregious
I know
example.
That HP had had 14 and 15 even recently.
Yeah.
And, no, but maybe they can make a convincing case for, you know, they're using it. So I just wanted to make a little in miscellany. This category, Revolution, the new J.J. Abrams future power outage global, sci-fi series started on Monday, and the jury's out in my instance. I read a couple very negative reviews. I'm less negative about it. Oh, we'll see how it turns out. It's too early to say.
I like the premise. I love dystopian future. The world is, you know.
Yeah, the acting seems fine. The people are interesting. We were teased at the very end. I mean, there is a definite, okay, what is
kind of Hunger Games-y in the plot, it seems to me, but.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point.
If somebody said, hey, that Hunger Games movie, that's real big. What can we do that's like that? What do we got in the bin?
Yeah, you know? Hey, JJ, can
you crank something out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lastly, for anyone who is interested in what we've been talking about recently, in multi-factor authentication for their own websites, I ran across an implementation of Google Authenticator written in HTML on GitHub. Yes.
Wow.
So
JavaScript or HTML? Must be JavaScript.
I don't know what it's in at that end. But probably if you Google HTML5 /google-authenticator, or may not even put the dashes, and it is at GitHub. You'll find it. And I just thought it looked nice. And so anyone who's interested in, you know, dropping that in to their own website to allow for, you know, Google Authenticator compatible authentication.
That's awesome.
And I'm sure we're going to see a lot of that. But I just wanted to point our listeners at it.
That's neat.
Yeah.
That's it?
That's it for
today. That's all she wrote?
That's it for today. That's our news, and when we have Mark, and we will do Q&A next week. So, by all means, if you got any questions, grc.com/feedback.
If you're just tuning in late, go back and listen to the beginning of the conversation. And Mark will be back for Windows Weekly tomorrow, which is just a coincidence. But I have a feeling we'll talk more about Windows. I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about the books. I don't know. Don't know.
And I'm jealous he's going to have a good microphone for that pop.
Yeah, thanks, Lou. Lou's running it over from the other side of the campus. Steve is at grc.com. That's where he keeps SpinRite. He hides it there, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and a recovery utility. Hey, the Ford Motor Company has 19.0.0.0 stroke 8, according to Considerate.
Wow. I wonder about these companies that have such... massive. I mean,
well, they have a lot of employees, and they're all over the world. But do they need it publicly routable? Is the question.
Yeah, exactly. And once upon a time, it was easy to do. I mean, we're gonna go through a period of you know, anxiety. The rebuttal, not surprisingly, from the UK group, this UK government department for work and pensions. Their rebuttal was, "Hey, IPv6." That's what it's for.
Right.
Go use that.
Yeah. Well, they're right. I mean, we need to move.
Yeah. Sooner or later, we won't
but
have
we don't need them to kick us in the butt to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, guys.
And then the question is, you know, in order for an organization like HP or Ford to give up their IPs, first of all, Leo, you are 100% right. They do not need publicly routable IPs. I mean, really, only servers need publicly routable IPs.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, everybody else can come out of a smaller pool of NATed IPs, which is, for example, what ISPs are doing now, which is what we all do in our home networks. You know, we've got one IP publicly and a bazillion inside our homes. So that scales in a hierarchy beautifully. Now, of course, there are, you know, internet diehards that are hopefully they're not dead yet. I was going to say turning over their graves to hear me, but you know, they're like moaning because they bemoan the whole notion of NAT. The original purist concept was one IP per machine, and every machine would be accessible by every other. Yeah, well, that was before firewalls. And before, you know, nation-state-supported crime rings of very, very good hackers began to happen. But my point was, if a company did want to give up some of their excess space, what they would need to do would be to move their allocation, all sort of compress it to one end of their network block. Essentially, you know, they would, for example, if Ford was it 17?
I don't remember what number it was.
Anyway, I know that HP, for example, has 14 and 15. If you took, or like, so say the UK Department for Work and Pensions, they've got 51.000, okay? There's no way they have 16. They need 16 million IPs. They couldn't have 16 million machines in the Department for Work and Pensions, no matter how bloated their bureaucracy is. So all they would have to do would be to move those, if they didn't want to switch to 10 dot, move them all to one end. So that right now, for example, there might be 51 dot, and then rather than zero, they might be using 0 and 1 and 2, and just sort of, you know, have come up with a very, oh, look, we've got 60 million IPs, we'll use 51.1 for this location, 51.2 for this location, 51.3 for that location. And the idea being that if they squeeze that down so they're only using, for example, zero, then that would free up 51.1 through 255. And they could keep their little 51.0 network, which is a small fraction of the total 51./class A network. They would essentially have a class B network. And that would be a compromise that would free up the bulk of their allocation. And of course, that scales. They might have, .1, .2, 51.1, .2, and .3, but be able to cram all of their allocation down into like three class B networks, and then again release their allocation for the balance. So I think we're going to see some back and forth and some tension as people resist the move to IPv4, just because it's not easy. It does require equipment and firmware and routing upgrades and so forth.
General Electric has 3.0.0.0/8.
Yeah.
IBM uses 9.0.0.0/8 for eternal IPs, supposedly. So there's a few out there.
Yeah, well, but once upon a time, Leo, 4 billion. We're never going to use 4
we'll never
billion.
We'll use all those. Yeah. No siree. Steve Gibson is at GRC.com. That's where SpinRite is. And, of course, your chance to ask questions for next week's episode, GRC.com/feedback/8. No stroke 8. He also has lots of free stuff there, including SpinRite, the world's... Oh, I said that. Oh, Shields Up. Shoot the Messenger. Decombobulator. All those other free things. Password Haystacks. All of that stuff. GRC.com. And 16 kilobit versions of this show in audio for the bandwidth impaired. Text versions, transcriptions by the great Elaine. We have the video and the high-quality audio over at our site, twit.tv/SN. But you're still putting show notes at security at your site, right, Steve? GRC.com?
I have not been doing show notes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
For a long time.
We'll get our wiki guy on it. We'll get him up to date. Yeah, because we're a few months behind.
The transcripts that we have really come in handy, because as I was reading about this the new crime attack, the compression ratio info leak made easy,
right.
I thought, Giuliano Rizzo, wasn't he on the beach somewhere developing
and the nice thing is it's text search, right? That's the beauty.
Yeah, so I went to grc.com/sn, which bounced me to /securitynow.htm. I put I think I might have put beach into the search box, and up
lo
came.
And behold.
Oh no! I think I put Rizzo in because I knew his name. And sure enough, there were three hits on that, and that's one awesome. Took me to Elaine's transcript from the time we were talking about the beast attack. So
fantastic.
Easy to find those things here.
All right, we're going to sign off. Coming up this week in Google, Jeff Jarvis in studio with us. We will see you next Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time.
Yep, for a Q&A.
Steve Gibson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Leo.
See you next time on Security Now.
Security Now.